Нам в руки попав документ несколько...
Путін планував захопити східні області України, розпочати з Харкова.
План отторження Росії ряда територій України составлений...
Крок за кроком пропустить послідовність вторгнення Росії, як саме...
Исполнителем проекта «Інтервенції» називають близького Кремлю олігарха Малафеєва.
Інформація, будто план окупації полуострова розробили ще до бігства Януковича.
Це неправда. Так прес-секретар президента Росії Дмитрий Пісков прокоментував публікацію...
The Kremlin, it appears, had a plan from the start. Weeks before the bloodiest days in Kyiv, weeks before Viktor Yanukovych fell from power and fled to Russia, weeks before the Euromaidan reached its climax, the Kremlin had a blueprint for war. And a blueprint for annexing not just Crimea, but large swaths of eastern Ukraine as well. Some of the plan was realized, some of it was not. But what does it tell us about the Kremlin's thinking and where the conflict may go from here? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU and expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And joining us via Skype, making his debut appearance on the podcast, is Anton Shekhovtsov, a researcher at University College London who has done extensive work on Russian and Ukrainian nationalism. Welcome aboard, Anton.
Hello, Brian.
Well, the opposition newspaper Novaya Gazeta this week, as we all know, published what it says is a Kremlin strategy document for Ukraine that was drafted between the 4th and 15th of February last year, that is, weeks before Yanukovych fell. It characterized Yanukovych as, quote, a person without morals and willpower, who was rapidly losing control of the country and whose downfall must be expected at any moment. To protect Moscow's interests, it suggests a strategy of breaking Ukraine into autonomous regions with the aim of attaching Crimea and southeastern Ukraine to the Russia-led customs union and eventually annexing it outright. The initial thrust should be in Crimea and Kharkiv Oblast, with the aim of ultimately grabbing everything else in between. As we know, some of it worked, some of it didn't. One thing it shows us is that Putin didn't launch this operation in Ukraine to protect Russian speakers from nationalists in Kyiv at all. But, I mean, let's face it, we all knew that anyway already, or should have. Anton, first guests get the first question by tradition. It's an old tradition, old venerable tradition we have here in the podcast. You've done research on Konstantin Malafeev, the wealthy businessman and promoter of Russian Orthodox causes, who was apparently involved with the drafting of this plan. What do you make of this document? What was your takeaway? Was this the plan or just one plan among many? What did you walk away from after seeing this document?
I think two things seem very clear to me. First of all, this is not a unique plan. This is not the plan. I've personally seen some of the plans that, you know, were close to it or were further away from the what was actually happening on the ground in Crimea and later. I think that there are so many think tanks in Russia. There are so many initiatives. And this is, I think, is a result of how the Kremlin works. It doesn't say to people, we want a plan that would work. No, other people who want some benefits from the Kremlin, they would be proposing those plans to the Kremlin. So I think this is one of the many plans that were submitted to the Kremlin. Second, I don't think that this is a work of the Malafeev group. I don't think that Malafeev writes anything by himself. Mm-hmm. This is a work of what I call the Malafeev group. And I don't see any traces of the works of Malafeev's group in that document.
Why not? Like, for example, what struck me, and it also struck the Novaya Gazeta editors, was the pragmatic tone the thing took. It was absent all of this romantic nationalism you hear from these people. This was a very cold, calculating document. But what did
you say? Absolutely. Well, first of all, if they did not really remove some valuable parts that would identify those parts with the works of Malakhev, probably some references to religious nationalism, for example, or Crimea as a sacred place for Russia. Mm. There is nothing like that in that document. And some pieces are missing. I mean, if that were indeed the Malakhev group, then Dugin would have obviously taken part in drafting that document. And if Dugin had been involved, we would have seen many references to, say, his cooperation and the cooperation between his neo-Eurasianist movement with some groups that were cooperating with his movement from Donetsk. Mm-hmm. For example, Donetsk Republic. This is the organization that was set up in 2005. And in 2006, its leaders went to Moscow. Its leaders went to a training camp that was set up by the Dugin movement. And Donetsk, if you look at that document, Donetsk Oblast, Donetsk region is not even mentioned there as a potential base for pro-Russian separatists.
This is very interesting. I was going to get to this later, but you brought it up now. This is one of the most interesting things about this document. The first thrusts are in Crimea. That's a no-brainer. But Kharkiv. Yeah. Kharkiv. But Kharkiv, if you remember, was the first People's Republic, if I'm not mistaken, was declared in Kharkiv, but it didn't fly. And Donetsk seemed, and even the document said, Donetsk will probably be difficult because of the influence of Akhmetov's people in Donetsk, who were basically siding with Kyiv or appeared to be siding with Kyiv at the time. So that was very interesting. But continue. You raised that.
Yeah. So there were connections, in previous years between the Dugin's movement and the Donetsk Republic. So there were contacts, there was cooperation. It was not mentioned at all. Mm. Also, a guy from the Malakhev group, which is Igor Strelkov, who played a great role in separating Crimea from Ukraine. He would go to Donetsk region again after Crimea, not to Kharkiv. Mm. I think that the idea that Kharkiv is mentioned in that document, it actually tells us a lot about the low degree of professionalism of the people who drafted this document.
Because they got Kharkiv so wrong.
Yes, and they got Donetsk so wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, actually, yeah, in reverse, for opposite reasons, yeah. Yeah. Mark, I want to bring you into the discussion. What was your takeaway from this?
Yeah, obviously, assuming that this is a legitimate document, which I'm sure it is, because the Novaya Gazeta people tend to know what they're doing.
They have a very good track record. Yeah. This was raised on Twitter today by a listener, yeah. and they have a good track record.
Right, but I think we do need to sort of just, you know, put down a marker on that point. Yeah, I mean, I definitely would agree with what Anton says. I mean, this is politics. This is pluralism as usual, Moscow style. you know, this is all. It's all about influencing the court. And one of the ways you do that is by sending paper in sort of the random direction of the presidential circle and hope it lands on the right desk and hope someone reads it and finds that it is good. So absolutely, this is not the plan. If nothing else, I mean, one has to note, first of all, that it was absolutely clear that Putin and co. were genuinely taken aback when Yanukovych did fall. I think despite the fact there are a lot of people saying this regime is not going to last, I mean, voices, you know, things like this paper, voices from the sort of the security and intelligence community are saying he's doing it all wrong. Nonetheless, clearly within a certain inner circle, there was a belief that sort of Yanukovych was going to last a bit longer. And secondly, I mean, annexation, which is after all a central element of this document, has clearly never been on the Russian game plan. If that was their aim, they could have annexed what they wanted already.
Well, I don't know about that, because they didn't want this little one-third of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast that they have now. If they could have gotten from Kharkiv to Odessa, or even Kharkiv to Mariupol, they would have. Yeah, maybe, they might have wanted to annex that.
Yeah, but you don't need to actually sort of wait until you've got the whole lot. I mean, this is not like a one-shot deal. I mean, you can make it clear that annexation is the goal. Quite the opposite. They have repeatedly said, no, 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 we are actually committed to the territorial integrity of Ukraine. Subtext, a Ukraine that we like. Close right. bracket. So, I mean, you know, I think it is clear that there is a very distinct divergence between the policy as outlined in this paper and the policy that is clearly sort of obtaining at the very top of the Russian political system. And I'd also mention that, you know, we shouldn't be surprised about a lot of all this. The notion that underpins all of this, that Ukraine is not really a state. The idea of using, whipping up and arming separatists. Again, this has been a sort of classic element of the Russian playbook elsewhere. And there's an excellent piece by Chris Miller in Russia magazine, where he, you know, lays out some of these aspects in which it is familiar. And we had people like, I mean, Sergei Glazyev back in September in Yalta was basically indicating that if Kiev doesn't watch out, just think what kind of anarchy and chaos is going to emerge. So actually another way of saying is also this is geopolitics Moscow style that is being embodied in this particular document. But yeah, just to pick up on a couple of minor elements. I mean, the Donetsk and Kharkiv issue. They absolutely sort of got it wrong. But I think we have to be aware of the extent to which actually, you know, in these operations, chance always plays a key role. I mean, in Kharkiv, it was particularly because the local police chief and the local police actually did their job, which is relatively unusual in Ukraine.
It was also because Kharkiv, though, it was also, though, and Anton could correct me if I'm wrong on this, but that Kharkiv is basically a very different place from Donetsk. It's not an industrial city. It has a long history. It was actually one of the birthplaces of Ukrainian nationalism. And so Kharkiv is Eastern Ukraine. Yes, it's Russian speaking. Yes, but it's a very different animal than Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, which are industrial and Sovietized in a lot of ways, more so than Kharkiv, despite the Stalin architecture you see in Kharkiv. I think Mark, you're right. The local police did their jobs in Kharkiv, and that, but there was more to it. There was more under the surface there than that.
But I don't think there's anything that says Kharkiv could not possibly.
No, Kharkiv surprised me. Kharkiv really. Odessa didn't surprise me. Odessa, sticking with Kyiv, did not surprise me. One, I lived in Odessa, and I know Odessans, but Kharkiv surprised the hell out of me. But continue. I just wanted to interject.
Yeah, I mean, and so likewise. I mean, I think we have to realize that the role that chance plays in all these things. That actually just the random concatenation of events on the ground and such like. All effective strategies have to be built with the assumption that lots of stuff is going to happen that you don't expect to happen, and then you have to respond. But I think for me, I mean, what was more striking is, you know, you mentioned this sort of very kind of pragmatic tone, absolutely. But nonetheless, again, a lot of the underlying assumptions, I mean, for example, you know, it's implicit that the West expects Ukraine to also break up. It is assumed that there will be this kind of demographic advantage, that actually the reason to annex the East is for reasons of population. Now, again, that speaks to an interesting little bugbear in certain Muscovite circles, the idea that basically, you know, the Slavs of Russia are not breeding enough compared with the non-Slavs. And therefore, well, if all else fails, let's annex ourselves some more Slavs to try and sort of, you know, rebalance that.
I've never quite heard it put that way, but yeah, that's.
I like to break new ground.
You have a way with words, Mark.
So, I mean, I think again, definitely, and again, I would really like to hear Anton's take on this. I mean, for me, this speaks to a different vein of the Russian nationalist movement, not the kind of loamy and emotional, you know, church and crown.
Or is Malafeyev more pragmatic than we think? This is because, Anton, if you don't see Malafeyev's fingerprints on here, whose do you see?
With Malafeyev.
Well, no, if you don't see Malafeyev's fingerprints on this, I mean, what I was looking at this thinking, it's somebody other than Malafeyev, or Malafeyev is a lot more pragmatic than we think. And I guess what I ask you, if you don't think Malafeyev's fingerprints are on this document, where do you think it comes from?
My only guess would be that this is the Russian Institute of Strategic Research.
Mm-hmm.
That
was my guess,
too. That they were quite active, or they started to be active, about a year ago. So that might be their document.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I would say that they are connected somehow to the Malafeyev group. They cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
But they are different think tank.
Right.
They're different, and if you look at their documents, the low level of their professionalism, of their expertise, is actually very, very similar to the level of expertise in that document.
Mm. Mark, you had something to say, something to add here.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would agree, because to me, the concerns that come up in this and the biases and assumptions actually are much more from the, shall I say, the kind of slightly more kind of pragmatic nationalist, but also a kind of Silovic nationalist mm-hmm. dimension. Because, for example, I mean, the whole issue of how many Slavs have we got also translates to how many Slavic soldiers have we got, or how far do we have to depend on people mm-hmm. in the Caucasus and such like. The assumption is kind of a very ruthless realpolitik that basically assumes that, well, ultimately the West sees the world the way we do. And it's just simply a question of just simply competing geopolitical blocks and geostrategic interests rather than there being anything about it. I mean, the interesting thing is, ironically, the slightly more hysterical patriotic wing, they actually put a great emphasis on culture and values and belief. And in their own way, they also see the West as being motivated by culture and values and belief. It's just, it's kind of evil. Everyone must be gay and everything else. You know, that's but nonetheless, you know, they do see this in cultural terms. This is a very, again, I mean, I think, you know, inaccurate, but nonetheless sees everything in how they see realpolitik.
Well, it's interesting you say inaccurate, because I thought the analysis was bang on. I mean, things like, The we can't count on the Donbass oligarchs because they prefer a weak Kiev to a strong Moscow. Things like that. Things like as the Euromaidan revolution was reaching its climax, they're like, okay, the political demographics of Ukraine are such that it is not going to produce a government in Kiev that we can work with. Therefore, we have to look elsewhere. There were parts of it that were just really, I mean, I thought it was coming out of the intelligence services. And then other parts of it.
Tactically apt. Yeah, exactly.
But other parts filled with mythology. Like the Euromaidan is not under the control of the systemic opposition. This is where the thing that really jumped out at me. Not under the control of the systemic opposition. They're obviously just a bunch of football hooligans and people from the criminal underworld who are controlled by British and Polish intelligence services. I mean, it was things like this utter mythology mixed with this sharp, spot-on analysis, which kind of confused me, because you would think the intelligence services know these things are myths and they're put out there for public consumption, but not when you're feeding something to the Kremlin, you want to give them accurate information, one would think.
Well, one would think. No, I mean, but the point is, I mean, we know that. I mean, obviously, we know that the British are behind everything.
Right.
But
everything
beyond
good,
that, well, no, absolutely not.
America, for example,
not perfidious Albion. No, I mean, but again, this is the thing. It's tactically, on the whole, quite shrewd. Okay, they got the Kharkiv Donetsk thing wrong, but on the whole, tactically quite shrewd. But in terms of the big underlying assumptions, dramatically misunderstanding the world. And the point is, again, that is something we have seen from the kind of military security side of the nationalist wing, of the sort that actually Putin is listening to. You know, the sort of Ivanov, Petrushev, rather than necessarily the sort of smarter desk officers and the general staff. You know, we've seen this time and again. And again, I think this therefore is one reason why, you know, one of the many reasons why I'd be behind Anton's sort of fingerprinting of where this comes from.
Anything to add there, Anton? You seem to indicate you wanted to say something.
Yeah, when I read that document, I constantly saw things that I actually missed from it. For example, if I were to draft such a document, I would look at the public opinion polls, where people, in what region people in Ukraine would prefer more cooperation with Russia. This document does not provide this analysis. Mm-hmm. And I think partly because of this, because no proper research has been done on the, you know, on the background of the problem, of their problem. Mm-hmm. And this abuses me.
Mm.
The shortage, the lack of proper research into the question.
One thing I wanted to throw out to both of you is, like, what if anything does this document tell us about the Kremlin's thinking? And I'm thinking in these terms. My assumption right now is, in eastern Ukraine, Russia basically got the worst part of what, if it wanted to take any part of eastern Ukraine or even control indirectly any part of eastern Ukraine, it basically got the worst part of what it wanted. About a third of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. They wanted Mariupol. They wanted Kharkiv. They, in their wildest dreams, they wanted Odessa. is there still a plan maximum and a plan minimum here? Or does this document tell us anything about what Moscow's maximum plans and minimum plans may have been and may be right now?
Well, okay, I'll start. I mean, firstly, this document does not tell us anything because this is not a formal plan. This is not the Kremlin strategy. So we can't read anything beyond that. Secondly, though...
But it's one of the things that was circulating around the Kremlin.
Yeah, exactly. But the main thing is, look, it doesn't matter what the plan was back at the beginning, you know, when this was sort of formulated. You know, it is clear that Russia is informed by, you know, as anyone's strategy would be, a combination of long-term sort of ideal stretch goals and just the practical needs of the moment. Today, frankly, I think, you know, if they could just take Mariupol, they would regard that as definitely a plus. Once upon a time, maybe they had grandiose notions of Odessa and a land bridge to Crimea and everything else. I mean, I think that to an extent, the situation on the ground will just reflect what they reckon they can get away with. But I think the key thing is we really must not lose sight of the fact that this is not a conflict whose end goal is determined by square miles of territory controlled.
Of course
they do not.
Not
want to annex. They want to basically put pressure on Kiev.
They want to have a veto over Kiev's decision-making. I've been saying ad nauseum throughout. But
quite frankly, if Kiev was willing to sort of surrender on those big political issues, I'm sure the T-90s would be pulling back tomorrow. And, you know, if it meant that good, loyal Russian speakers were being hung from trees in Donetsk, again, I don't think Kiev can
surrender on those big issues because
Ukrainian
society will not allow it. The political demographics are such that Ukrainian society will not allow that right now.
But the point is, we have to see that, as it were, what Moscow wants is not something that is determined territorially. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, what Moscow might end up getting as the plan B, as the consolation prize, or the key thing is just not to be seen to lose. They'll just see what opportunities arise.
Well, this is something that I've gone back and forth on this. I mean, I agree with you, Mark, and I've said repeatedly on the Daily Vertical, on this podcast, I've written on my blog that this isn't about Donbass, this isn't about territory, this is about having a veto over Kyiv and over Ukraine's future, basically. But yet, by removing Crimea from the Ukrainian political equation in effect, I mean, my first thought on that was among my first thoughts on this, like, wow, this is going to change the political geography of Ukraine quite dramatically. It basically tilts it back when we were thinking in orange and blue terms over to the orange team, so to speak, the pro-Western team. If you remove even more of Ukraine from that equation, it turns Ukraine completely orange, right? So, yeah, on one hand, they want to keep these territories in Ukraine, but on the other hand, annexing more doesn't seem to be off the table or not. Anton, what are your thoughts on this? You're closer to this than either of us.
I think that first of all, the whole Ukraine crisis, so-called Ukraine crisis, it's not really about Ukraine. Russia is not fighting with Ukrainians; it is fighting with the West. And if you look at 2008, and if you look at 2013, 2014. You will see the same rhetoric coming from Putin and from the Kremlin, that the Kremlin wants to renegotiate the conditions where Russia has its own sphere of influence. It's the same rhetoric.
But Ukraine is ground zero of that sphere of influence, so to speak. There can be no Russian imperial project and no Russian sphere of influence without Ukraine.
Sure, but Ukraine as such does not matter. It's not, you know, it's not a territory, it's not nothing. It just... But it also, if you look at Russian strategy over the years, you will see that sometimes and very often it acts according to the approach two step forward, one step back, which means, for example, it occupies South Ossetia, but this is step one. The step two would be to invade so-called Georgia proper, and then negotiations with the West will not be about South Ossetia or Abkhazia. Mm-hmm. It will be about removing the troops from Georgia proper in order to keep step one. I think Crimea was step one for Russia, and the invasion in eastern Ukraine was step two in order to negotiate with the West about this particular step two. in order to step back to step one and be okay with this.
Right. And no, you're right. Nobody is talking about Crimea now. But I think a lot of this is about Ukraine, and I don't think that's incompatible with this also being a battle with the West to rewrite the rules of the post-Cold War order and give Moscow a sphere of influence in the former Soviet space, because Ukraine matters to Russia for a number of reasons that we've talked about a lot in this podcast. Some of them historical, ideological, emotional, but some of them pretty damn pragmatic, like money laundering and the military-industrial complex, energy. One of the things that jumped out at me in this document was the concerns about losing control of energy flows to Europe via Ukraine. So Ukraine itself matters, and it also matters because it's always been my belief that there can be no Russian imperial project without Ukraine. With Ukraine, Russia's an empire. Without it, it's just a country, right? I forget who said that first, but it's been said, and I tend to agree with it. So Ukraine matters, and if you get Ukraine, well, that's the big enchilada in your sphere of influence. The rest are quite frankly side dishes to Moscow. They matter, but you can't have any Russian imperial project without Ukraine. I recall a conversation I've talked about this a lot I had with a Yeltsin advisor back in the 90s, and he was discussing the decision to break up the USSR and why why the Russian side came to acquiesce in that decision. And he said it was when Ukraine voted for independence. And I said, why is that? And he said, Kakoy Soyuz bez Ukraine, right? And this is, I've told this story a million times because I think it is so, so telling, the importance that Ukraine applies. Now you get Ukraine and then you're well on your way. You've just rewritten the post-Cold War rules if you're able to do that. And the rest comes rather easily, I think. So I don't think these two things are mutually exclusive, but I've just talked a lot, so I'll let you guys jump back in.
I would actually go back to the argument of Mark when he said that Ukraine does not really exist for Russia. It's not a state. It's right. Not a real state. It's Russia's interest in Ukraine, as you say. It's in the destruction of Ukraine, that this project does not exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They would take some parts that would be left of Ukraine and then integrated them into Russia or in Malorossiya or Little Russia. That would be in a region in Russian Federation.
But where does this stop? You leave a rump Ukraine starting where? The Dnieper River or where?
No, Ukraine, that's Kiev. You know, Russia can't lose an idea of Kiev being a mother of the whole Russian world or the first Russian city. Ukraine proper for Moscow and for those crazy geopoliticians. This is three Western regions, maybe a bit more, maybe five.
Which they probably hope would just reunite with Poland.
Galicia. This is Ukraine. This is not proper Russia, because good Ukraine is actually not Ukraine but Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But bad Ukraine, this is even not Ukrainian. This is a Galician. This is an invention of Austria-Hungarian Empire. But
this is another way that they amazingly just got Ukraine so wrong, because Ukraine has, if you look at the evolution, and I wrote about this on the blog, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, Ukraine has evolved in a completely different way. And it's not, there isn't this good Ukraine, this what Moscow would call good Ukraine, bad Ukraine, I guess what we would call orange and blue. This is melted away in a lot of ways. And
how can you possibly think in terms of a Ukrainian, if you don't believe Ukraine exists? How can you wrap your head around the fact of thinking that Ukraine has precisely changed, but also has changed on a trajectory that sort of creates a Ukraine, mm-hmm. or whatever? I mean, I think, again, this is the extent to which they are absolutely confined by their ideological and geopolitical preconceptions. I mean, and here, again, I think Anton was spot on. I mean, I could conceptualize a sort of three-part, that, you know, much like Gaul, Ukraine is in three parts, that there is a Novorossiya, which is just part of Russia, that there is some kind of Kievan protectorate that is, in effect, part of Russia, but they might not actually make it part formally within Russia's boundaries. And then, yeah, Galicia, let the Poles have it, let it be independent, who cares? But, you know, frankly, let all these troublesome Western, you know, Who wants Ivano-Frankivsk? Well, God, send it out there.
You keep going back to, I mean, if we remember the little controversy over Ben Judah's interview with Radek Sikorsky, where Donald Tusk was supposedly saying that Putin approached him with this plan to divide Ukraine between East and West, between, you know, a partition of Ukraine between Poland and Russia.
This is,
the Polish officials walked back this, but that's, you know, when Ben wrote that, that's not the first time I heard that idea was out there in Russian officials' heads.
Going back to this notion, again, which I think is one of the key underpinning leitmotifs of this particular document that we've been talking about, it's this very geopolitically oriented. I mean, in those terms, actually what Putin offered seems to make good sense. Why shouldn't Poland want this or whatever?
Right.
It's just that when you actually layer on minor issues of things, everything from international law to, you know, to,
right,
to general natural
common
human
sense,
to the idea of actually going to, of all countries, Poland.
Right.
Saying, how about partitioning a neighboring
right.
country? That works out well. For all these reasons, I mean, it is lunacy, except in the very, very so narrow confines of the world as seen by a particular
so
kind of
Russian. So they
believe
their own hype. See, this is what – I guess this is the big eye-opener for me, is that they believe their own hype. I never – I mean, I always thought that Kremlin strategists were much more savvy about – especially about Ukraine, for God's sake. If they're not going to get Ukraine right, they're not going to get anything right. Right. And they got Ukraine so wrong because they were so blinded by ideology. They believed their hype so much. Is that what the conclusion we can reach here?
I'd say two things very quickly, and then I want to hear what Anton said. I mean, one is, again, we mustn't say the Kremlin. I mean, there are some people who say certain things with a twinkle in the eye that says, I know this is rubbish. You know, this is rubbish. But, you know, but I can get away with this, through to the people who genuinely believe all kinds of lunacies. The second point I'd make is, you say, oh, well, you know, if they even get Ukraine wrong. I mean, in some ways, actually, it's the things that are closest to us, the things that we're actually less able to really be rational about. So in some ways, it doesn't surprise me that people who might be really quite smart about how to, I don't know, play the intricacies of Hungarian politics, but can just so completely mess up when it comes to Ukraine.
Yeah. Anton, any last words on this before we move on to the second part?
I think that indeed one of the conclusions, one of the most important conclusions, is that Russia has been just simply misunderstanding Ukraine for a very long time, at least from 2004, when it could do nothing about the Orange Revolution. Simply could, they sent their best political technologies to Kiev,
mm-hmm.
simply could do nothing.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, this lack of expertise, of real expertise on Ukraine, is actually one of the problems of the Kremlin. They fear that a color revolution would come to Russia. No, it wouldn't come, because Russia is not Ukraine. Ukraine is not Russia.
Yeah,
they didn't have to fear any color revolution in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
They fear that something like this, like something like the Ukrainian Revolution of 2014. Could have happened to Russia. And because of this, they started to feel really, really paranoid.
Yeah.
No, it's two very different countries.
And you should be able to reach this conclusion, not by diving deep into Ukrainian history, which is relevant here, but by just looking at the development of these two countries since 1991, for God's sakes. Ukraine has had five presidential elections since 1991. In three of them, the incumbent has lost. The incumbent's only won once. Kuchma in 99. Russia's had five presidential elections, and either the incumbent or the handpicked successor has won every single damn one of them. I recently argued, it goes back to two dates in the early 90s. October 4th, 1993, when Yeltsin shelled the parliament, and in July 10th, 1994, when Kuchma beat Kravchuk, and Kravchuk stepped down. It was these two precedents that were set this trajectory. And it just still blows my mind that they don't get this. Mark, you're right. We always get wrong that which is closest to us, I guess. In a few moments, we will shift gears and we'll broaden the aperture a bit and look at two other former Soviet regions where Russia's also flexing its muscles. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype, making his debut, but I hope not last appearance on the podcast, is Anton Shekhovtsov, a researcher at University College London who has done extensive work on Russian and Ukrainian nationalism. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
В Псковской области России начались плановые учения воздушно-десантных сил.
Офицер штаба противника обезоружен,
скручен. Всерьез опасаются страны Балтийского
Российская
региона.
Российской армии царит полный порядок, и учения всегда плановые.
Автоматные очереди, выстрелы из гранатомета. Учебное поле, как театр на
эстонской границе, в Псковской области начались учения.
Russian paratroopers recently held maneuvers near the border with Estonia and Latvia. In December they held them near the border with Lithuania. Moscow has also signed agreements with Georgia's separatist Abkhazia and South Ossetia regions that effectively abolish their borders with Russia and merge their military and security and customs agencies with Russia's. It's getting quieter in Ukraine as the ceasefire appears to be holding for a couple of days right now, but it's getting noisy elsewhere. It's a reminder, as Anton said in the first half, this isn't just about Ukraine. In an article this week in the National Interest, Fiona Hill made an argument, one that I've made in the past as well, that Putin and that Anton made in the earlier part of this podcast as well, that Putin's ultimate goal is to rewrite the post-Cold War rules and grab a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. She writes, quote, "Now that he essentially has the Crimean city of Yalta back in the fold, Putin wants to turn the clock back 70 years to the old Yalta Agreement of 1945. Mark, is she right? And if so, I suspect you think she's right. I think she's right. Anton seems to think she's right. Is he succeeding?
Oh, heavens, yes, absolutely. It's a very rare day that I'll disagree with Fiona.
No, I wouldn't dare.
I'm not afraid.
No,
I think that, and actually, there's, if we have time, there's actually a point I'd like to make precisely about the ceasefire in Ukraine. But yeah, going back to this issue of is he succeeding? Well, it's paradoxical. On one level, absolutely, he is succeeding. He is destabilizing the old order because he is basically in a position to, as it were, comment that the emperor has no clothes. And although the emperor does still have some clothes, it's clear that actually the emperor, you know, doesn't have a finely brocaded robe.
The emperor needs a new tailor.
Well, I mean, exactly. He's probably wearing little more than some rather flimsy boxer shorts, because there are distinct and sharp limits to what the Atlantic Order is able to do. Because he's worked out that you don't just simply send tanks across the border into Estonia or whatever and immediately trigger Article 5 and force that kind of response. That, you know, their new hybrid political military techniques are working at raising a lot of the internal tensions. So, as ever, I mean, he's successful as a disruptor. However, what he's not at all, I would, successful at is in terms of creating something in its stead. I mean, I think this is going to be, this is the key weakness for Putin.
But Russia all he is wants is that sphere of influence. All he wants is that sphere of influence, I think.
You see, all he wants is that sphere of influence.
Well, that's, actually, that means a lot to Ukrainians and Georgians.
Yeah, but also, Russia is not a strong power. Russia is currently leveraging its power most effectively and, in a way, throwing a lot more of its resources into its projection of power. But still, we're talking about an economically and politically weak country. You know, if it came to a straightforward slugfest, if one looks at, you know, all the algorithms of whether it's tanks or economies or whatever, the European Union without the United States, frankly, you know, is far stronger.
If it had the will.
Than Russia. Aha, well, there we come to the point. Will is fine. Will is all very well. But, you know, will is, as it were, what takes you up to that point, and everyone's thinking, good Lord, actually, you know, how strong this country is, until you finally come to that crunch point. So Putin's entire strategy depends on bluffing. I mean, I've come to really loathe that whole Putin's playing chess and everyone else is just playing checkers.
No, nonsense.
He is not a grandmaster. He is, if we're going to play the analogy at all, he's a poker player. And so he's relying on bluffing everyone. But the point at which actually someone says, we're going to call you, that's the point at which the
weakness
becomes
obvious. But what does calling him mean?
Well, I mean, it can be micro scale or macro scale. I mean, on a micro scale, it could be doing something that actually he said, no, it's not acceptable. Like, for example, sending weapons to Ukrainian military. I think it's an interesting
debate.
Which
you've argued against very, very articulately.
Well, I haven't, actually. I mean, I think actually there is a lot to be said for providing weapons, but not because I think it's going to completely change the situation on the battlefield, but because I think it's a powerful political signal. The only thing I've been arguing at is, for God's sake, if we're going to do that, let's anticipate that Putin will have a counter move, because they've been thinking about it, and have our move. I mean, what tends to happen is the West, we move, and then Putin responds, and we think, good Lord, that wasn't meant to happen. Mm-hmm. And we're right back to the drawing board. So I'm just simply saying, let's please think carefully about that. But, you know, I mean, I think that also the more he pushes, it's as it were, destabilizing the current Atlanticist model, which actually, like it or not, is very even-handed. And what he's creating coming out of the Phoenix is the risk of something that is much more Cold War-y, much more actually anti-Russian, forcing people to take sides.
And that's a fight he'd lose.
It's a fight he'd lose, exactly. And particularly if it's a fight which, if it comes radicalized, I mean, he's counting on China always as his...
China,
his
which just announced
backup.
It's going to give Ukraine big energy help today, by the way.
Exactly. I mean, this is the Chinese are not the little brothers.
If anybody's playing chess in this game, it's the Chinese.
Oh, God, I suppose we'd have to have a whole new, you know, decide which
five-dimensional
game
poker or whatever they're playing, but they're playing it well.
Yeah, quite. No, I mean, I think that you might say Putin is doing a good job of destabilizing the current status quo. I think what Putin will find actually is that the status quo protected Russia rather more than hemmed it in. And if we actually really did end up, I mean, if I had to disagree with Fiona, which I'll do just for the sake of making sort of the argument a little bit more interesting rather than simply saying, go read her piece. He may want the Yalta Agreement. But implicitly, actually, what he's really arguing for is a sort of 19th century pre-international law, pre-UN, etc. sort of structure. I think, actually, Russia in that kind of environment would find itself in a very uncomfortable position.
Yeah, because of its weakness, you mean.
Right.
Antoine, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I would agree with almost everything that Mark said. I do believe that currently, at this very moment, Russia is winning. Because it is destabilizing Europe, it is, it does contribute to the problems of the transatlantic cooperation. It does have a toxic effect already on some Central East European countries, like Hungary, for example. Or something may happen in Greece with Syriza and independent Greece being very pro-Russian. And then Cyprus. Look at Cyprus. There will be a military base of Russia on Cyprus. And okay, this is a non-NATO state, but still, this is something very, very different. And I think he would not have achieved this if he had not created such a situation that we are facing now at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So he will be trying still. He will be pushing forward because he can't stop now. As Mark correctly said, he's playing poker. But he has to bluff all the time, and he has to raise the stakes all the time.
Do you think the West is getting to the point where it's ready to call the bluff?
Maybe, probably. And actually, that would not be even sending arms to Ukraine. Putin believes that there are already U.S. arms in Ukraine.
Well, he says it. I'm not sure if he believes it.
Yeah, but this is very important. Well, he said that the army in Ukraine is a NATO legion.
Right.
This is very important, how they perceive the situation. An important step for the U.S. would be say, yes, we are sending U.S. arms to Ukraine.
Mm.
But now the Security Council of Ukraine said they've already got the arms, probably not from the U.S., but you can buy U.S. arms
not only from the U.S. Places. Right, right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something else that caught my attention in the last week was U.S. military armor personnel carriers paraded in Narva, Estonia, during Independence Day celebrations. We're talking just, you know, a few hundred meters from the Russian border here. That it was my first reaction. Was like, we're playing the same little game of, like, you know, whatever, provoking them around the edges. But it was more than that. I mean, there was the policymakers in the West clearly feel a need to demonstrate that there's boots on the ground in the Baltics right now, which said to me, wow, they do take this very seriously. And several, from the British defense minister to the deputy supreme allied commander to former NATO Secretary General Rasmussen, have all said there's a real threat to the Baltics. Is there, Mark, what do you think? Is the threat to the Baltic, because that is a, you want to talk about high stakes poker. It doesn't get much more high stakes than that. It really would put us, that would really basically like be a call to arms. That if you don't defend the Baltics, if you don't invoke Article 5, if there's even a hybrid war situation, you don't have to roll the tanks across the so-called friendship bridge from Ivangorod into Narva to start a war. You can do a hybrid war situation in Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania, and NATO's in this weird, uncomfortable position. Is this an Article 5 violation or not? I couldn't get an answer to that question when I was in Brussels talking to NATO officials. Right? Is Putin just brazen enough to try this?
Well, again, just a little sideline it's worth mentioning. And the two friendship bridges I know, there's the one you mentioned into the Baltic and there's the one into Afghanistan. Again, that's a slightly unfortunate parallel. I'd make two points. One is that of course, the Russians are not going to be foolish enough to sort of launch an overt challenge against a NATO country.
But like, a hybrid like one? A little green man challenge?
This is the thing. It's actually, you know, it's still, I mean, just as we found with the whole issue of the cyber attacks on Estonia, with NATO havering about whether or not that actually counted as an attack, when clearly it should have. But the point is that There's sometimes a sort of a glib assumption that things sort of proceed too neatly. I remember the commander of the Estonian military forces saying, you know, actually, dealing with little green men is easy. You just shoot the first ones and that deters the rest. But my view is actually, the point is, the first little green man, quote unquote, will, you know, is more likely to be a 14-year-old Russian Estonian schoolgirl waving a banner. Mm-hmm. Of course you don't shoot her. And then maybe the next wave will be 16-year-olds throwing bricks. But they're Estonians. The whole point is that the Russian aim is exactly to escalate things so slowly and so indirectly. Of course, it's going to create sort of challenges that NATO is still not really geared to. I mean, NATO is, let's face it, a military alliance, and this is not a military challenge. And quite frankly, although, you know, I applaud what the Estonians are doing, for example, about spending money on their military, one can raise the interesting question about whether they actually need tanks or soldiers, or whether actually they need riot cops, counterintelligence officers, and social workers to ensure the integration of the Russian population. Right. That's a whole separate issue. The thing is, though, that we shouldn't assume that if escalation begins, it's going to be well controlled. And, you know, I think this is, you know, going back to Anton's point about the fact that sort of Putin can only escalate. He's caught in this position, or he has caught himself. We shouldn't feel sorry for the man. Even if the Russians think, well, we're just going to put a little bit of pressure on the Balts just to distract NATO, create a bit of division or whatever. Firstly, you might well find that the local agents actually begin to take things into their own hands and bring it further than you'd intended, which we have certainly seen in Ukraine. Secondly, you know, you might find yourself kind of committed to a position that actually is increasingly uncomfortable, and therefore you might just feel you have to push further rather than appear to be stepping back. And these things are sort of naturally become volatile situations. So I don't believe there is any plan to try and actually sort of move into NATO territories at all. Because there's nothing else. What do they want with territory full of people who hate you? They have enough of that in the Caucasus. But instead, they'll be aiming to put pressure, and they might find themselves sucked into positions, or we might then respond in a way that they hadn't anticipated. So it does become a very volatile thing. And I think that the point about the armored personnel carriers in Narva is, firstly, it's also a symbol to the Balts.
Yeah,
we do genuinely have your back, which is, I think, really important. But secondly, I think in some ways it's a bit of an overkill of a symbol, precisely to say, look, you know, this really is a front line. This really is not somewhere to mess, because we are in an unfortunate position which is actually much more volatile than for most of the Cold War.
It was also interesting how the citizens of Narva, most of whom are Russians, greeted them. They were very positive towards the presence of American armor, which was a pleasant
surprise.
Yeah,
I mean, we shouldn't assume that just because Russian is your first language, desperate to live under Kremlin control.
I think Ukraine teaches us that. And I would also add, you mentioned Little Green Men. I mentioned Little Green Men. It was 1 year ago today that term came into existence.
Which might explain why today has just been named the Day of the Spetsnaz.
Yeah, it's the
in Russia. Right. Okay, so mystery solved.
Anton, anything to add here?
I was listening to Mark, and there was I remembered a very nice line from the US Prime Minister about the salami tactics of the Soviet Union that might be in place here as well. I think that Putin will be trying, you know, bit by bit to destabilize further. He will be experimenting. This is the most unpleasant part for political scientists who deal with Russia, because there is too little rationale. There's too little rational plans coming from Russia. Mm. Putin is playing. Putin is experimenting. Sometimes it's just different initiatives, and he looks at them whether they would work or not.
Right.
This is one of the problems. His complete, irrationality.
I forget who wrote it. There was an interesting piece I read last week. It said Putin is winging it, and that's the most dangerous thing of all. There isn't a plan. He's just winging it. We're getting tight on time here. And Mark, I know you wanted to say a couple of words about the fact that the ceasefire does appear to be holding for the last 2-3 days. What did you have to say on that? Because that is an interesting development.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say two things. One is that, yes, of course, the Russians will allow ceasefires to happen because it works in their interests. I mean, their style of warfare is essentially to pulse and then hold, pulse and then hold. They expend a hell of a lot of ordnance when they're fighting, and they therefore need to resupply. So we shouldn't assume, unfortunately, that ceasefire is anything meaningful in that respect. But the second point to make is actually that the current ceasefire, especially unless and until Western military weapons are provided, actually works very much to the Russians' advantage. By pulling back all the heavy artillery and heavy weapons, what that means is actually that the Ukrainian forces on the line of contact are really undefended if the Russians throw in their heavy armor. The T-90 tanks that they've been deploying, there is nothing that Ukrainian sort of shoulder-fired weapons and so forth can do to them. These things, T-90s, will just eat up anything that the Ukrainians can throw at them. And, within an hour, basically, their tanks could be at the front line. Mm-hmm. So, actually, the ceasefire has created two quite dangerous situations. Yeah. One
and
is...
the border's open on top of it all.
Yeah, the border is open, as you've mentioned, exactly, and that allows constant resupply. It means that at any point, the Russians can actually launch operations from a very, very strong position. And thirdly, because absolutely we want the killing to end, this lulls us into a sense, that's all right, things are great. And I think this is why, although clearly any ceasefire, any prisoner exchange is a very, very good thing, but we really need to see that actually, up to now, every time there has been an agreement, every time there has been a lull, it has actually worked in Moscow's favor. Yeah. Because it's only intended to, and we've allowed the Russians to build it as such, as a temporary gathering of forces, rather than thinking in the long term of what actually is going to lead to real peace.
Mm-hmm. Anton, last word to you, if you have one.
just a few words. I'm being very pessimistic about every ceasefire that was declared in this war, because it didn't hold. And it's not in the, I don't believe that the ceasefire is in a plan of the Russians. It will not hold. I never believe that it will hold. Mm. So it just, a few days, a few weeks maximum before everything is restarted.
I got a slightly different take. I think the Kremlin thinks it can pursue its goals politically, its goals of basically decentralizing Ukraine to paralysis. I think they can. They think they can do that politically, and the ceasefire allows them to do that. War is politics by other means. Politics also is also war by other means. But we'll see in the coming weeks, I guess. And that's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype, making his debut, but hopefully not last appearance on the podcast, has been Anton Shakovtsov, a researcher at University College London, who's done extensive work on Russian and Ukrainian nationalism. Thank you, gentlemen, for a very enlightening discussion.
My pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.